Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week we're looking at the portion Yitro, or Jethro in English, which goes from Exodus 18:1 through 20:23, or if you're reading a Christian translation, it would be 20:26. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
The portion of Yitro tells how Jethro meets with Moses and with the people of Israel, and how Israel arrives at Mount Sinai, where God comes down on the mountain in glory and declares his Ten Commandments to his people.
So this portion begins by saying that Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, hears about everything that happened with the people of Israel and comes out to meet them in the wilderness. So when Jethro arrives, Moses goes out to greet him and he kisses him and welcomes him, and he explains to Jethro everything that happened and all the great things that God did for Israel in Egypt, and also about all the hardship that had befallen them on their journey and how God still delivered the people of Israel no matter what happened. After he's heard about everything that God has done for Israel, Jethro says, "Blessed be Adonai," or the Lord in English translations, "who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hands of the Egyptians. Now I know that Adonai is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people." So we read previously that Jethro was a priest. He was a priest of Midian even before he ever met Moses. We don't know exactly a priest of what god. We just know that he was a priest. And so here he's saying, "Now I know that Adonai is the great God," indicating that possibly he didn't know before. So this is showing that because he heard about what God did, now he's understanding that Adonai, the God of Israel, is the greatest God of all.
And it goes on to say, him being a priest and all, he actually offered burnt offerings and sacrifices to God. And then he
ate a meal with
Moses and with Aaron and with all the elders of Israel. So this is pretty interesting because Jethro is not an Israeli. Mm. He's not a Hebrew. He's a Midianite. But when he heard about what God did to Israel, and because of his connection with Moses, he was still able to serve the God of Israel.
Right.
And have fellowship with God's people, Israel. It's kind of showing, again, a parallel between Moses and Yeshua. Mm. Through Moses, Jethro has a connection to the people of Israel. Even though he's not part of Israel, he's connected to Israel and he's able to serve their God because of that connection he has with Moses. In the same way, the Gentiles are not Jews, but they're able to serve the God of Israel through Yeshua, who is very much Jewish, and he's the deliverer of the Jews. But when the Gentiles who were far off are able to hear what Yeshua did and how God delivered Israel through Yeshua, they're able to come near through Yeshua to serve the God of Israel together in fellowship with Israel, even though they're not Israel.
Right.
In Yeshua, there's unity.
The both are made one into one new man, as Ephesians 2 says. So after this, we read that on the next day, Jethro sees Moses judging the people of Israel, basically deciding between disputes between Israelis. And he's doing this all day long. From sunup to sundown, there are people standing in line waiting to be able to talk to Moses for him to settle their disputes. And so Jethro comes to Moses and says, "The thing that you are doing is not good." He says, "You are going to wear yourself out. You're going to wear out the rest of the people. This is a really bad idea. Here's what you should do. You should delegate your job of judging. Teach the whole people about the commands and statutes and the Torah of God. Explain to them what they're supposed to do. And then pick people out from among Israel to act as judges and set them up in tiers, basically. You have people who will judge groups of thousands, groups of hundreds, groups of 50s, and groups of 10s, basically to settle the smaller, more minor disputes. And that way, if they can't be resolved by the lower down judges, it'll get worked up until it gets finally to Moses. This is actually an inspiration for America's court justice system having multiple different levels. So I just found this to be very similar to what we read at the end of the last portion, where Moses was having to keep his arms up during the battle, and if he let his arms down, the people of Israel would lose. So he had to keep his arms up, but then he got tired, and so he had to have Aaron and a guy named Hur hold his arms up. He had to have people to help him to bear the weight of the responsibility of what happens to Israel. And so here, Moses' father-in-law is counseling him again, you need people to help you. You can't do this all on your own. It won't just be bad for you, Moses. It'll be bad for the whole people. It'll wear them out too, is what he says. And so I thought that was a really good principle, which is don't put everything on yourself. Whether it's in a religious circumstance or in a governmental circumstance, I mean, this is kind of both here. But in either situation, all of the authority shouldn't rest on one guy all by himself without any help at all. The ultimate authority should rest with God. Subjugated to him would be God's servant. So that would be Moses here, or in our case, it's Messiah. God is the head of Messiah, and Messiah is the head of the called forth, or the body of Messiah. But then subjugated to that, authority should be divvied up. There should be help. One person shouldn't be doing it all by himself.
Yeah, again, to go back to something Paul talks about, we're all one body. All the members have different functions. Mm. If we all did the same thing, there would be issues. Mm. You have to divide the functions so that each person can take a part of the burden. We're supposed to carry one another's burdens. Mm. We shouldn't leave all the burdens on one person.
Right.
So it's not only a message to say, delegate to others, but also take burdens from other people. Mm. See how you can lend them a hand. Don't leave it all up to them, because you're part of the body too, and God made you for a function.
There are active roles for everybody in the body. We shouldn't just be takers. We should be givers. We should be helpers.
Because when everybody's a taker, it's even bad for the takers.
Right.
When no one was doing any of the work except Moses, that was bad for everyone because it was too much work for one person to do. When we try to put all the work on one person, the work doesn't all get done, and everybody suffers. But if we work together under the leadership of Messiah, then we can accomplish all the work.
And just one more thing that I want to bring out about this is that Moses didn't just pick anybody to be judges. Jethro specifically said to pick people who feared God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. So these are people of upright character. It's very similar to what Paul says to Timothy and Titus, giving qualifications for people to be overseers and servers, different positions of helping and leading and authority and service in the body of Messiah. So in order to qualify to help and further God's cause, you have to be a person of character, a person who walks according to the scriptures.
So after Jethro goes home to Midian, the people of Israel move on and they come to the wilderness of Sinai. And there's a mountain there, Mount Sinai, and it's not just any mountain. It's the mountain of God. It's the mountain where Moses already met God at the burning bush. Mm. When Moses was at the burning bush, God said to Moses, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. So this is the fulfillment of that. Moses led the people of Israel to the mountain, and now he's going to serve God on that mountain. And the function he's going to serve is going up to the mountain to talk to God and back down to talk to the people. So kind of a mediator going back and forth. So Israel stops at the mountain. Moses goes up, and the first thing God says to him is, tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. Mm. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So God is saying, I brought you out of Egypt. I redeemed you for myself, just like I said I was going to do. Now I'm offering you the covenant. If you obey me and you keep my covenant, I will use you. You will be a holy nation, a kingdom of priests for me.
The language that God uses here is really important because he says that they're God's treasured possession from among all the peoples. So first off, he's saying that God picked Israel and they're different from any other people on earth. That's why he says you will be a holy nation. The word holy means to be set apart, to be especially clean and different and not like the other things so that God can use it. And so God is saying, out of all the ethnic groups on the whole planet, I picked the people of Israel. They are mine to be a kingdom of priests. A priest is someone who basically mediates. A priest will represent the people before God and represent God before the people. He acts as a go-between, like you already said about Moses. Moses was going to the mountain to hear God's words and then tell those words to the people. And then whatever the people said, Moses would then bring that back up to God. And in doing so, Moses was able to bring the people of Israel near to God. In fact, the Psalms call Moses a priest. And so in the same way that a priest does this, God is saying, if you keep my commandments, then you'll do this on a national scale for the whole world. We've already talked multiple times in previous videos about how basically Israel is the vehicle by which God's salvation is made known to the nations, to all the peoples of the earth. And so God is saying, if you will walk in my covenant, if you are faithful to that, then you can live up to this calling that I have given to Israel to be a kingdom of Kohanim, of priests. It's very similar to what Isaiah says in Isaiah 49:6, where he says that I've called Israel to be as a light to the nations for my being to salvation to the end of the earth. God is saying, if you will follow me, you can bring all the nations to me, to God, so that they can follow God as well.
Kepha, or Peter, actually refers back to these words in his letter in 1 Peter 2:9, when he says, you are a chosen ancestry, a kingdom of Kohanim, a holy ethnicity, a people treasured as God's own, so that you may proclaim the excellences of him who called you out of darkness to his wondrous light. You who were once not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not found loving kindness, but now have found loving kindness. When Kepha says this, he's addressing the temporary residents of the dispersion, the diaspora, much as James or Yaakov was also addressing the 12 tribes of Israel who were in the dispersion. So Kepha is saying to the Jewish people who are scattered among the Gentiles, he's saying, you are a chosen ancestry and a kingdom of Kohanim, and that you're holy. And so he calls on them to keep from the fleshly desires that war against the soul, having your behavior among the Goyim right, so that in that which they speak against you as evildoers, they may glorify God in the day of inspection. What he's saying to his fellow Jews is, in Messiah, you have a calling to proclaim his excellence and to live rightly, to live a holy life. So even when you're scattered among the Gentiles, even when you're not in your homeland, you can fulfill that calling to be that chosen ancestry by living in Messiah, living apart from the flesh, living righteously. And when you do that, even when the Gentiles around you oppose you, just as the Egyptians opposed the people of Israel, it will be to God's glory. And the best way to fulfill that capacity, to realize that holiness, is in our Jewish Messiah, Yeshua.
The only way to realize that holiness. Yeshua is the fulfillment of the entirety of Jewish faith. What could be more Jewish than following the Jewish Messiah? And apart from Messiah, you can't live righteously. Apart from Messiah, the Torah brings nothing but death. It only brings an opportunity for sin to live inside you. And without Messiah, there's no solution to that sin. In Messiah, we have the ultimate fulfillment of this call to be a kingdom of Kohanim. In fact, Paul will say in one of his letters, he was acting as a Kohen, as a priest, in his ministry to the Gentiles. So the only way to walk according to this covenant, it says, if you will keep my covenant, if Israel will keep God's covenant, then they can be this kingdom of Kohanim. And we've seen throughout Israel's history, over and over again, Jews do not keep the covenant. We continually stumble, we continually stray. But the prophet Jeremiah says that God would make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, one in which he would write the Torah in our hearts, and we wouldn't need to teach one another how to follow God, because we'll already know. All of us will know God in the new covenant. The new covenant which is established by Yeshua.
Yeah, it's a very sad thing that a lot of Jews look at faith in Yeshua as for the Gentiles, not a Jewish thing, when in fact it's the fulfillment of this very declaration right here. We fulfill our purpose and calling as Jews in Messiah. Apart from Yeshua, we can't be the Jews we were meant to be. But in Yeshua, we find that fulfillment. We become that kingdom of Kohanim, that holy ethnicity. So when Moses repeats these words to the people of Israel, their response is, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So it's a resounding, yes, we will keep the covenant.
And then we will be that kingdom of priests.
Yes, yeah. We're accepting that call. Now, as we've already seen with the people of Israel, their devotion to God fades pretty fast. So we're going to see that even though they said we're going to do it all,
they're not exactly. How long will that last?
But for the meantime, that's the go-ahead. Moses reports it to God, and God says, okay, I'm coming. I'm going to come in a thick cloud, and the people will hear when I speak with you, and may also believe you forever. So God has said to them, if you keep my covenant, I'll make you a special people. And they've said, okay. So God's like, okay, now I'm going to make the covenant and I'm going to do it in style. He's going to make it glorious so that when the people see and hear, they will remember and they will believe in God and in his power.
And in Moses.
And in Moses. And so since God's saying, I'm going to come there, they're going to see me, I'm going to be in their presence. He says, there needs to be some preparation for this. We're going to take 3 days to consecrate the people. Tell them, wash their garments. Don't go near a woman. Be ready for the third day. So he wants to make sure they're clean and holy, presentable when they come before the king, as it were.
And God is so holy, you can't just bring your filth into the presence of God. When God comes near, you need to wash your hands, as James says. You need to be clean if you want God to draw near to you.
And on top of that, the mountain is so holy, Moses says, whoever touches the mountain will be put to death. We're going to set up limits. There's going to be a
barricade around the mountain.
And no one can cross it. No one can touch the mountain or they're dead. If someone does touch the mountain, don't touch the person who touched the mountain. Kill them with an arrow or with stones. Don't touch them because they've touched the holy mountain. And so it's showing even when the people clean themselves, there's still this
separation.
Even this kingdom of priests who has cleaned themselves to come before God is still limited in how they can approach him because he is so holy and we are so filthy. That if we try to come near him,
there are consequences. Yeah,
we can't come to God on our own. So they get ready, and on the third day, God shows up, and there's thunder and lightning and thick cloud
and fire
and fire
and smoke
and a loud blast of a shofar. And so all the people are trembling from the fear of this sight. And
rightfully so.
And the mountain is also trembling. And so Moses brings the people out closer to the mountain to meet God. So now the people are having an encounter with God. And Moses speaks to God and it says, God answers in thunder. And in the middle of this terrible sight, the shofar is getting louder and louder. Everything is loud and dark and flashes of light and fire. And God calls Moses to come up. So no one was allowed to touch the mountain.
But Moses
says,
is allowed to
Moses,
touch the mountain.
Come up.
Oh, man.
And when Moses comes up, what God says to Moses when he comes up is, go back down and tell them, don't touch the mountain.
Right. I mean, Moses just touched the mountain, and so God's sending Moses back down to say, yeah, I went up the mountain. None of you guys can go up the mountain.
except Aaron.
Except Aaron, yeah.
God says, go down, tell them again, don't touch the mountain, and then bring Aaron up with you. And Moses says, we already set the barricade. And God says, make sure when you're coming through the barricade to come back up that none of the priests or the people break through to touch it. Because if they do it, they'll die. So just be really, really careful.
Yeah.
No one can touch the mountain except Moses and Aaron. And so, again, like we already said, this kingdom of priests can't touch the mountain. But Moses can't. And Aaron can't. Because Moses and Aaron are his priests in another capacity. And so it brings this really interesting question of who is the priest for the priests? This kingdom of priests was called to be holy and to clean themselves so that they could come in the presence of God. And they could come in the presence of God. They were able to see God without being killed.
Yeah, this is like the most visible God has made himself to any people in the history of the planet so far.
Yeah, but there's still a limit. The people still need a mediator, a priest, a Kohen, to come between them and God. The reason being, they're not holy enough. As holy as they are, they're not holy enough. Mm. And so it shows, in order for the people to fulfill their role as priests, they need a priest. And the reason for that is their own limitations. Now, Moses and Aaron also have their limitations. Mm. We've already seen God almost wanted to kill Moses earlier.
Right.
For his sin.
Against the covenant. He wasn't keeping the covenant.
And as for Aaron, we'll see his problems later. But it shows that even the Kohanim that God sets up for Israel have their own weaknesses, their own limitations, such that even as they offer sacrifices on behalf of Israel, they have their own sin to worry about. And so there's a limitation on how close they can get to God. It shows that they need another priest. Yeshua, a high priest of a greater order, a heavenly order, an eternal order.
And one who did not sin.
He did not sin. He was completely blameless. And so he was completely holy. There was nothing holding him back from coming near to God. We're going to read a lot of places where God says to the priests, be careful if you don't do things right. When you try to come near to me, you'll die. But Yeshua did everything right. Yeshua is completely holy and blameless. So he can come near, and so he can intercede for us to bring us near. He can bring the sons of Aaron near. He can bring the sons of Israel near. And
he can bring all the nations
all
near.
The nations near. When we bring them to Yeshua, Yeshua brings them to God. Everyone, no matter how far they are, can come near to God through Yeshua and through his chosen nation of priests, whom he is a priest for.
So after this, we begin chapter 20 of Exodus, which begins, then God spoke all these words, saying. This seems like an insignificant verse, but I just wanted to point out here, usually throughout the Torah, and Adonai spoke to Moses and said. Here, it doesn't say God spoke to Moses. As it makes much clearer a little bit later in the narrative and also in the parallel retelling in Deuteronomy, these next words which God speaks weren't spoken to Moses. They were spoken to the whole people of Israel. God's thundering voice roars out from Mount Sinai in the hearing of all the people of Israel. So these next words which God speaks are super duper important. And those next words are the Ten Commandments. More accurately, these aren't actually the Ten Commandments. The Hebrew actually means the Ten Words or the Ten Matters, basically 10 things that are said. The very first one says, I am the Lord, or Adonai, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So this very first, not commandment, but first of the Ten Commandments, is foundational to the rest of everything that is said in the Ten Commandments, because it's establishing who is giving these commands. This is Adonai, the God of Israel, the God who set Israel free from slavery. He's saying, by everything that I've proven before now, in my faithfulness to the promises of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in my mighty deliverance of the people of Israel, in the 10 plagues and all that, through all that, you know that I am your God. That is my authority by which I am giving these commands and the authority by which I'm requiring you to keep them.
Yeah, we've already seen him tie everything in Genesis to his name and then everything he's done since then to his name. And so now God is saying, that was all the foundation of the authority and power of my name. And now from that authority, I command you that which I now command you, in my glory, which you are now hearing with your own ears.
Right.
So the next thing he says, on the basis of that authority as the God who delivered Israel from Egypt and who made the promises to Israel, is, you will have no other gods before me. The God who delivered Israel, the God who formed Israel, is the only God for Israel.
Right.
He's saying, you can't have any idols, no images, don't serve them, don't bow before them, just me. He says, I am your God, I am a jealous God, and I visit guilt on those who hate me, and I show my kindness to those who love me, but I'm your God, no other gods. That's the second word, but it's
the first rule.
Rule number one.
The reason why God says he's jealous here is because he's already shown he's the greatest God. He's the only God. And so if we worship what isn't God, if we worship false gods, other gods, anything else, if we worship and bow down and serve anything or anyone other than Adonai, the God of Israel, we are taking what rightfully belongs to God and giving it to someone else. It would be like a wife messing around with some other dude. It's taking what belongs to one person and giving it to someone else. God is jealous. He deserves all the honor, all the glory, all the worship, all the praise. And if we give that to anyone or anything else, it says that he will visit iniquity of fathers on children to the third and fourth generation. In other words, there are consequences for your sin that don't just apply to you, but they apply to even your offspring going forward. Sin has consequences and it reaches to those around you. But God proves his character in that he also says, to those who love God and keep his commands, he shows loving kindness to the thousandth generation. Yes, God has wrath for sin, but he also has loving kindness and mercy for righteousness and love. And that far outweighs his wrath. And so if you want to get that overflowing, abundant loving kindness that stretches far into the future, if you want that, you have to love him and keep his commands, not be giving what belongs to God to false gods. So then we get to the third of the Ten Commandments, which says, you shall not take the name of the Lord, or Adonai, or Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. You shall not take his name in vain, for Adonai will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. So we've mentioned ever since the burning bush that God has been putting weight on his name, which is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. There's a whole episode of the Biblically Correct podcast about how to pronounce the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is we can't because that pronunciation is lost, hence us saying the Lord or Adonai instead. And in fact, part of the way that the pronunciation of his name was lost is because of Judaism's understanding of this command. They basically said, well, if we shouldn't take God's name in vain, then we shouldn't take any risks and we should avoid saying his name altogether. And so after generations of that, the pronunciation of his name was lost. But the command here is not about not speaking God's name aloud. The point of this command is about God's reputation, about everything that he's tied to that name. That the reason why his name is so holy is because it's the name of the holy God, and he's attached the weight of his reputation, all that he's done, to that name. Taking it in vain, or another translation would be to make it empty, to think of God's name as something light, as something unimportant, to treat it casually, is to basically drag God's reputation through the mud. God is not someone to be treated casually, and his name and his reputation should not be treated casually.
We've just established how God builds everything on this name and how he's tied everything to this name, and that we shouldn't serve any gods other than the God with this name because he's a jealous God. God values his reputation. And when we use his name emptily, we treat it as if it has no value, we're rejecting everything God tied to that name. Mm. We're dishonoring his reputation and so dishonoring all that he did for us. We might as well be saying, this God is no God at all. No wonder God won't hold us guiltless.
Right.
God will defend his honor. God will defend his name, his reputation. A reputation which he specifically tied to his people Israel. And so, in the sense that he's called us and tied his reputation to us, we as Israel have a unique and special burden of carrying that reputation. A special calling to not render that reputation worthless through our actions.
You can take God's name in vain in more than just, you know, using his name as a swear word when you stub your toe. If you swear falsely in God's name, if you do any evil thing in God's name, then you're tying God's reputation to sin. We've already seen how holy God is and how if they couldn't draw near the mountain because they would die because of their own unworthiness. And so by dragging God's name into your own sin, you're basically doing the unspeakable, which is to make God sinful, make God dirty, which that can't be done because he is perfect and holy and set apart from anything sinful and unclean. But you can drag his name into your sin and uncleanness. And God is saying, if you do that, there are very severe consequences.
The next command is remember Yom HaShabbat and keep it holy. So interestingly, this one was one he had already commanded. And he had said when he was giving the manna, there was going to be a test to see whether they would keep his commands. And the command was Shabbat.
The command was, don't go gathering on Shabbat like you normally do. Rest on Shabbat.
Rest on Shabbat. Keep it holy. Don't do what you did on the other days. So also here, he says, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Shabbat to Adonai your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. No one is supposed to do any work. This is a Shabbat to Adonai.
Right.
It's a holy day. It's taken out of your week just for God. And it doesn't just extend to gathering manna. It's whatever you do.
Right.
Whatever is your normal work, don't do it on that day. That day is a day for God.
And the word Shabbat in Hebrew means to cease or to stop. Basically, Shabbat is a day you stop everything you're doing. Drop everything. This is a day for God. It's a Shabbat to Adonai. No work, no normal activities, just a day for God.
And as we said before, he gave this day at the start as a sort of test. And we've seen, if you can't keep Shabbat, what can you keep? God is saying right here, this is one of the critical commands. This is
one of the top 10.
Yes, one of the top 10. This is a day for me, just as we're supposed to honor God by not having any other gods, and we're supposed to treat his name with honor. He's now saying, that was my name, treat it with honor. This is my day, treat it with honor.
More than that, it says to remember the Shabbat day to keep it holy. We already said holy means set apart, different, special for God. In a way, it's not even supposed to be part of your week. It's separate from the rest of your week. There are 6 days for working. It's actually, interestingly, it's not 5 days and a two-day weekend. It's a six-day work week, and then 1 day set apart holy for God. And the reason why he says this, he establishes, I set apart the day of Shabbat because I did it. God says, I kept a Shabbat. He hearkens back to Genesis 1. He says, in 6 days, Adonai made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them. So establishing that he's the creator. And he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, Adonai blessed the Shabbat day and made it holy. We read all the way back in Genesis that Adonai blessed the seventh day and made it holy. And God is saying, that's why going forward, I want you, my people, to do the same thing that I did on the seventh day, which is to rest. I made that day holy, so now it's holy for you too, Israel. This is my Shabbat. Keep it because I made it holy.
Again, there's sort of a tying of reputation here. He's saying, in so much as I'm the creator, this day is for me. So when we keep the Shabbat, we're honoring the God who created everything, and also the God who, I am Adonai, your God, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, going back to commandment one. If we don't keep the Shabbat, we're not honoring either of those things. We're not remembering either of those things. If we can't remember Shabbat to keep it holy, then how are we remembering God?
The Torah will later call Shabbat itself a covenant. Going forward for Israel, Shabbat is a covenant. And that's why in the top 10 commandments for Israel, the Shabbat is one of them. This is foundational to the fiber of Israel's being. So next we get to command number 5, which says, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which Adonai your God gives you. Now, later in the New Covenant scriptures, Paul actually points out that this is the first command that comes with a promise. God says, honor your father and mother, and he basically says, if you do, then you'll live long in the land of Israel. I also wanted to point out that there are no exceptions to this command any more than there are exceptions to the other 10 commandments. It doesn't matter who your father and mother are, you have to honor your father and mother. So this is the first command that God gives that has to do with interaction with other people. The past commands have been about how you honor God as he's the God of Israel, as not having any other gods, and even keeping the Shabbat holy. He says that's a day for him. Here, God is saying, honor your father and mother. He's pivoting toward, I've already established how you should treat me. Now, this is how you should treat other people. And the very first people that you're supposed to treat well are your parents. You owe your parents honor. No matter what they do, you owe them honor. That doesn't necessarily mean that in every single circumstance, like if they're opposing God actively or something like that, there are circumstances where we must obey God rather than men. But in all instances, you have to honor your parents. You have to treat them with respect and dignity. In fact, there's a later Torah command that says that if you curse your parents, that warrants the death penalty. So the treatment of your parents is a big deal. If you can't even treat your parents well, who raise you, who take care of you from childbirth, if you can't even honor your parents, how can you treat anyone else with respect?
God is our heavenly Father. Mm. So if we don't respect our own Father on the earth, how can we respect our Father in heaven? Mm. Our parents have authority over us. I mean, when we grow up, we leave our father and mother and cling to our wife.
Yeah.
But especially as children, we are under the authority of our parents. And so in the same way as you're under the authority of God and you're supposed to honor God, you honor your parents. And even when you're older, even when you're your own man, as it were, you still owe them for all they've done for you. You still owe them for bringing you into this world as much as you owe God for bringing you into this world.
Right.
God created you and you owe him. Your father and mother created you.
And you owe
you
them.
You owe them.
You have to honor them. That is a debt that you owe to your parents for your whole life.
So the next command that God gives is, you shall not murder. Pretty straightforward. In fact, it's so straightforward that it's not new. It was pretty obvious from the beginning. And God spelled it out, not to the people of Israel, not to Moses, but to Noah, way back in Genesis 9, when he said, and for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So God had already told it to Noah. So it's not just for the people of Israel, but for all mankind.
Yeah.
Because all mankind was made in God's image. And when you are killing a man,
you're violating God's image. This command, both here in the Ten Commandments and to Noah, it speaks to the sanctity, to the holiness, to the value of human life because people are in the image of God.
And it's not just don't do this. It's God said to Noah, I will require a reckoning for it. Mm. There's a price for it.
And later in the Torah, it establishes for Israel, yet again, if you murder someone, you die. There's no payment for that. If you murder someone in cold blood, there is death penalty, according to Torah.
And once again with this one, especially in consideration of Genesis 9, we see that this commandment also has a sort of transference of how you treat God to how you treat people.
Exactly.
Just as you honor your parents because they created you, just like you honor God who created you. Don't kill people because they're in God's image. And just as you respect God, you should respect your fellow man because he's in God's image. You shouldn't tarnish that image any more than you would tarnish God's name, which
we've already established that's a big deal. But there's even a deeper aspect to this command, as Yeshua himself brings out in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. The plain sense of this is just don't kill people. But there's also the spirit of this command. Yeshua says, you heard that it was said to the ancients, you must not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry at his brother will be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, empty fellow, will be in danger of the Sanhedrin. And whoever says, rebel, will be in danger of the Gehinnom of the fire. So Yeshua is saying, this goes way beyond just don't murder people. He says, don't even have anger and hatred in your heart toward your brother, because in a way, you're murdering him in your heart. And I think that a really good example of this is with Cain and Abel, which we read, which was the first murder. It says in Genesis 4 that when Cain's sacrifice to God wasn't accepted, but Abel's was, it says Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. And so then God said to him, watch out, sin is crouching at your door. But then Cain didn't master his sin and he allowed his hatred to progress to actual murder. And so that's what Yeshua is saying, is all murders stem from hatred. You've already murdered that person in your heart. It's just a matter of whether or not you've actually gone through with it in your actions. And so Yeshua is saying the heart of the command, do not murder, is do not be angry and hate. Yes, there are certain types of righteous anger, but the kind of anger here is hatred of your fellow man. You hate his guts. You want to kill him. So even if you don't actually kill him, if you want to kill him, if you hate him, you've already done sin. You've already violated the spirit of this command. So command number 7 is also another short one. It just says, you shall not commit adultery. Very straightforward. And it again goes back to something that we read earlier in Genesis. We've already referenced the passage, but it says, God created man, male and female. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall stick close to his wife. And they, the two, will become one flesh. So in Genesis, God established the pattern for marriage going forward. And so God is saying here, if you're married, don't violate that. Just like how if Adonai is your God, you shouldn't be giving your honor to some other God. If you have a wife, you shouldn't be going around messing with some other woman. Marriage is holy. Anything that messes with that bond between one man and one woman, which God established in the beginning, anything that messes with that is contrary to God's will.
It says that the two of them become one flesh. Mm. And so when you violate that marriage, you're harming both members of the marriage. Mm. It's an assault to both people and to what God has created. And so it's a sin against God and against men, and it's terrible all around.
Right. And again, Yeshua expounds on this command and talks about the heart of the issue, which is if you even look at a woman with lust, then you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. So just like how hatred is murder in your heart, lust is adultery in your heart. You want to go and sleep with that woman. And so whether you actually do that or not, your heart is not right and your heart has violated this command.
Yeshua says that the evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings out evil things. If your heart condition is evil, then what you bring out from that is evil. Both this command and the previous one reflect this. If you have hatred in your heart toward your brother, or if you have lust in your heart toward a woman, both of these things are evil in your heart, and it brings evil in the world. Evil in the world is not the source of evil.
It all starts in the heart.
Evil comes from the heart of evil people, and the heart of man is wicked. We all have evil in our heart. Like God said to Cain, the sin is crouching at the door, and you must master it. Only Yeshua can redeem us from that evil. So when we have these evil desires in our heart, it's not just a lesser version of the evil. It's the source of the evil. It's the core of it.
Right. It's the worst part of it.
It's the very essence of
it. These commands are saying, don't do the deed. And Yeshua is saying, don't have the seed of that evil deed. Next, we get to command number 8, which says, you shall not steal. And this is fundamental to just how human societies are supposed to interact. Stealing is wrong. There are multiple core aspects of society and of righteousness that come from you shall not steal. Namely, possession / ownership. You can't steal because that thing belongs to someone else. Property is real. People have a right to have their own property. You do not have the right to take their property. In the same way that God is jealous for worship and he won't let that go to other gods because it doesn't belong to those other gods, it belongs to him. In the same way, God is saying people have possessions. People have things which belong to them, which are theirs by right, and that cannot be violated for a person either.
This command is, again, pretty straightforward, but it illustrates that same concept again of if you wouldn't do it to God, don't do it to your fellow man.
Right.
The next command is, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So this command seems specifically to be in the context of testifying about your neighbor, as in court.
Right. Oftentimes this command is oversimplified to just do not lie, but this is a more specific command.
It's specifically about how you treat your neighbor. Torah teaches later that on the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses, someone should be put to death. So when you're bearing false witness about someone, if it's witness towards something that would make them worthy of death, and that witness is false, you might as well be killing that person.
Well, The thing is, there's actually a Torah command which says if you're found out to be a false witness and you were witnessing to something that would supposedly get your neighbor killed, then that false witness gets killed. Anything that a false witness testifies against his neighbor, the punishment for that crime goes to the false witness.
Yeah, so this is not just general lying to although, save your own hide.
Yeah, although lying that's definitely is definitely bad. Condemned.
It's specifically the sort of deceit which has malicious intent to harm your neighbor. Mm. You want something bad to happen to your neighbor, so you're accusing him of something he didn't do. This is actually something that a lot of people did to Yeshua. Mm. When he was being tried after he'd been arrested, and the leaders were trying to find a cause for death. And so they called up witnesses, false witnesses.
And they kept disagreeing with one another because they were all lying.
Fortunately, Torah says two or three have to agree. But there were so many people who were bearing that false witness because they wanted Yeshua harmed. Mm. They wanted a cause for death for Yeshua. And they came up with the accusations later. Mm. So that's showing it's not just lying. It's about trying to harm your neighbor. And so right. It's like these other ones, like murder and adultery and stealing. It's you're violating that person. You're trying to ruin a person created by God.
Basically, all these other commands have been about things that you do. Well, most of them. This is about things that you say. It's actually similar to the concept of don't take God's name in vain, where we talk about how his name carries his reputation. Don't falsely soil the reputation of someone else. Again, if you wouldn't do it to God, don't do it to a person. And the final command is summed up in you shall not covet. The full thing saying you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And so, interestingly, this command goes along really well with what Yeshua was saying in Matthew 5. This is talking about the heart condition. This isn't about anything that you're saying or doing. This is about what you want. This is really the heart version of you shall not steal. And it's also the heart version of you shall not commit adultery because it says you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. This last command is basically God saying, yes, I don't want you to do bad things, but I also don't want you to want things that are wrong.
Yeah, you can't just go around devoting yourself to evil desires without doing evil things. It doesn't
work.
It doesn't mesh.
Yeah.
But if your heart is in the right place and you aren't coveting, then these other things should follow naturally.
And one more thing that I want to point out about this final command is that Paul also says that covetousness is idolatry. It's kind of a weird phrase, and he doesn't really elaborate on it at all.
Well, it goes back to something we talked about a few portions ago when we were talking about the parallel Paul draws between the magicians of Egypt and those who swerve men away from the truth, who are lovers of themselves
and lovers of money. Yeah.
And lovers of pleasure. Those people were devoting their love and their desire to things that are not God, when they should be giving their love
right.
to God.
And the greatest command in Torah is you shall love Adonai with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength.
And so the command here, you shall have no other gods before me, for I am a jealous God. Mm. He's saying that honor and that love and that service belongs to me. And so when you are instead loving things that belong to other people,
lusting after things that belong to people,
you're not giving your love to God. You're giving your love to things that are not God. And that's idolatry.
So yeah, anything can be an idol if you treat it that way. Your neighbor's possessions can be an idol. Yourself can be an idol. Anything can be an idol.
I think what Paul says here in Romans 13 really kind of sums up all of these Ten Commandments. Mm. He says, return to all people their dues, to whom fear the fear, to whom honor the honor. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who is loving the other, he has fulfilled Torah. For you must not commit adultery, you must do no murder, you must not steal, you must not covet. Mm. And if there's any other command, it is summed up in this word, in this. You must love your neighbor as yourself. The love does no evil to the neighbor. Therefore, the love is the fullness of the Torah. If your heart is full of love to your neighbor,
You won't murder him or commit adultery against him or steal from him or covet.
You're not even going to covet what is his.
Yeah.
If your heart is right, you're not going to do any of these things. Mm. As for the earlier commands, if you give what is due to those to whom it is due, then you will honor God and you will fear God. Mm. And you won't serve any other gods because all the honor is due to God. And you'll honor your parents because the honor is due to the parents. If you honor those to whom honor is due and love is filling your hearts, then you've got it all covered.
Right.
So that's the Ten Commandments. God spoke them all from the mountain with his own thunderous voice. And all the people of Israel heard it as they saw the thunder and the lightning and the smoke. They were hearing the shofar. And so they were freaked out. And so their response is actually to get away from the mountain and to say to Moses, don't let God speak to us anymore. You speak to us. We'll listen, but don't let God speak to us anymore or we'll die. This is really interesting because God said he wanted the people to hear and then believe Moses forever. And their response is they've seen the glory of God. They're afraid.
And they say, Moses, you talk to us.
Yeah.
Moses, you give us the words of God.
Moses has already gone up to the mountain and survived. Mm. Whereas all the other people are rightly afraid to come anywhere near the mountain because they'll die.
It is very interesting. God is the one who chose Moses for this intercessory position. And now the people are basically reaffirming that call. It's like, Moses, you need to intercede for us. Yes. So both God and the people have said, Moses, you need to be the intercessor who goes between us.
And so Moses says, okay, don't be afraid. God did this. God spoke to you himself to test you and to make you afraid so that you wouldn't sin.
Right.
He wanted to show his power, to prove his point, to put his fear in them so that they would follow his commands. And now Moses is saying, the point's been made. You're very afraid. Don't be afraid anymore.
Right. It's both fear and don't fear. He's saying, don't fear because God's not doing anything bad to you right now. He's just testing you. But he's saying you should fear because now you know what God can do to you. Remember this so that you won't sin. That's what the fear of God is supposed to be. The fear of God isn't like he's a bad God, he's a scary God, I don't want God. The fear is I'm afraid of what he'll do if I sin against him. I want God on my side, I don't want to go against God. So don't be afraid of God. Perfect love casts out all fear, fear that God will judge you if you're not sinning against him. But if you do sin, then you should be very, very, very afraid.
And so now that God has made that point and declared his words, and the people know the basics of what's required of them, and they say, Moses, it's you from here. We don't want to hear any more of these commands from God. Moses then draws near to the darkness, near to the mountain where God was. And so God begins to speak his commands to Moses. For Moses to give the Torah to the people of Israel. And so when God starts to talk with Moses to repeat the things to Israel, what he says is, tell Israel, you just saw what I can do, so don't make any gods. Okay? You got it? I already told you that myself. Don't make gods. But you can make an altar for me, and you can sacrifice on it. So this is very interesting. He's inviting the people of Israel to make altars to God and to sacrifice on them with some rules.
Yeah.
He says, don't make steps. He says, don't hew the stones. Don't use your tools to work on it. But you can make an altar of earth or you can make an altar of stone and just sacrifice to God. And he says, in every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. So he's just shown all his power and filled the people of Israel with fear. Mm. But now he's saying, don't make gods, but come and serve me. Offer sacrifices of peace, and I will come to you and bless you. On the one hand, he's saying, that's my power if you do evil. But on the other hand, he's saying, here's my kindness and openness if you want to come serve me. I'm available to be served anytime. I'm available to come to you anytime.
Later in the Torah, God will establish mandatory sacrifices. But this kind of altar, these aren't mandatory sacrifices. These are just, I want to give something to God. And so before he's even established the sacrificial system, God is saying, if you want to give something to me just because you want to give to me, here's how you can do it and I will be pleased with you.
So I think the major summary application from this, I've already kind of said it, and Paul said it, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. make sure you're not owing something to God by giving him what he deserves. Give him the honor. Give him the fear he deserves.
And the love he deserves.
And the love he deserves. Don't go giving that to other people. And don't deprive other people of what's due them. Don't violate the honor of other people. And on top of that, love them. Love God. Love your neighbor. If your heart is full of love, these commands, which form the bedrock of the whole Torah, will flow naturally. So, honor whom the honor is due, fear whom the fear is due, love whom the love is due, and that's everyone.
That wraps up the portion of Yitro. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion of Mishpatim, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.